Greetings, humans, and welcome to another edition of the Sensitive Skin Magazine podcast. I'm your host, Bernard Meisler. I'm the editor-in-chief of Sensitive Skin Magazine. And our guest today is Patrick O'Neill. Patrick is a writer whose memoir, Gun Needle Spoon, came out a couple of years ago. And he's currently working on a new memoir, his as of yet untitled touring memoir, which recounts his days as a roadie and road manager for such eminent bands as Flipper, the Dead Kennedys, the Ramones. He worked with just about everybody back in the 80s. He's had a very interesting career. After the music stuff fell apart, he was left with some bad habits, which led to bank robbery and jail. And while in jail, he became a writer. And he's a terrific writer, and he's a great guy. And we had a pretty interesting conversation. We talked about his background, his checkered past, as I call it in the intro. And then we got around to general bitching about the publishing industry these days. And after all that, at around the 45-minute mark or so, Patrick reads an excerpt from the previously mentioned touring memoir, which he's currently working on. All right, enough about me. Can you dig it? Ladies and gentlemen, without further ado, here is Patrick O'Neill. So I've got Patrick O'Neill here, the most excellent Patrick O'Neill, who's a very, very good writer, fine writer. And we're going to talk to him a little bit about his checkered past, perhaps his checkered present. I don't know.
like a checkered cab.
Yeah, a checkered cab. We've all got plenty of checkers around here.
My dog Checkers.
Chinese Checkers. We got it all.
Well, thank you for having me, man.
Yeah. And so I just wanted to start asking you, let's go back to the beginning. Where'd you grow up?
Well, I mean, I grew up all over. My dad's a linguist, and so we traveled. And every year, I would be in a new city or a new country. He was a associate professor, so we were all over the place. Like, born in Madison, Wisconsin, Durham, North Carolina, Eugene, Oregon, Reykjavik, Faroe Islands, Denmark. Wow. Back to the Massachusetts, was in Arlington, and then Cambridge. And then my dad left. Mm. So all of that all led up to being about 14 years old.
Okay.
At that point, moved to California, and from 15 on was in San Francisco.
Okay. That's pretty wild. So you've been all around the world.
Oh yeah, yeah. We were well traveled. My dad, unfortunately, never wanted to go study a language in a warm place. It was always some freezing cold tundra.
Where's the Faroe Islands again?
The Faroe Islands are between Iceland and Denmark, and they used to be part of Denmark.
Oh, must
they're
be
literally like little tiny islands out in the middle of the North Sea. They're just like crazy, and they're the ones that do that. You know, they go out and they get a school of whales and beach them and slaughter them, and water turns red with blood and everything like that, and they hack them up, and people are kind of protesting against that these days.
Yeah, I guess
can't treat the whale like that.
Can't treat the whale like that. And no. So you ended up where in California, San Francisco, or
first ended up in Fresno for 2 years. And if you can imagine going from Boston to Fresno, California, which is the middle of Valley and Oakeyville, pretty much a culture shock, freak out. And could not wait to desperately get to the Bay Area, moving to San Francisco in the 70s.
And did you do that by yourself, like when you turned 18, or?
At 18, with my mother soon followed. But yes.
Okay. And for those of our listeners who are not familiar with California, Fresno is by many marks the worst place in America.
If Bakersfield is the armpit, then Fresno is, you know, the anus.
Yeah, yeah.
For sure.
My daughter actually was randomly assigned a city in California to study when she was like in eighth grade or something like that. And I was looking
at it. It was Fresno?
And she got Fresno. Yeah. And it was like, highest alcoholism rate in the United States, highest use of methamphetamine, lowest education level in the United States, lowest income level in the United States.
Yeah. Highest level of suicide probably too.
Yeah, worst air pollution in the United States.
Right. Although, but Cher was born there. She came from there.
Oh, okay. Well, that makes up for it all.
There you go.
And you coming from there. Your hard scrabble Fresno background's right, made you the man you are today.
Yeah, back in the day.
Yeah.
Side of the tracks.
Yeah. So what brought you to San Francisco? Is it just like you were dying to go there, or did you go to school there, or?
In all our travels, we'd visited San Francisco. I always wanted to be in the Bay Area, and if I had to live up on California, then it was definitely going to be San Francisco at the time was really happening. And I got a scholarship to go to the San Francisco Art Institute.
Uh-huh. Okay. So you were a visual artist when you started out?
Yeah. Yeah. Actually, to tell you the truth, I was the youngest nationally published cartoonist in America at the time. I wrote a comic for a publication called Kids Magazine. It was later bought by Junior Scholastics and stuff like that. And I wrote a monthly comic for that. And I was always into the visual, into the writing. I thought I was going to be a cartoonist one day.
Uh-huh.
So it changed up on that.
Cool.
Yeah.
And then so what school did you go to again?
San Francisco Art Institute.
Okay. San Francisco Art Institute. That's the good one, right?
That's the good one. That's not CCAC or whatever it's called. Right.
Well, there's San Francisco Art Institute is
bad one.
There's a very well known, highly regarded art school. Meanwhile, there's the Art Institute of San Francisco.
Right.
Which is owned by Goldman Sachs. It's one of those private owned diploma mills where like they'll let anybody in if they can cash a check, basically.
Yeah. No, I would. The San Francisco Art Institute was a fine arts college, which basically meant they taught you art and no way to survive when you made it. Mm-hmm. You know, because you were a fine artist, we were supposed to, you know, you're supposed to suffer.
Right.
That's how it worked.
Right. Well, I actually taught at the Art Institute of San Francisco for a few years.
Nice.
And I would tell people that, and they would confuse it with the San Francisco Art Institute and be impressed. And they go, wow, that's really amazing. And I was like, yeah. I didn't correct them or anything.
Nice. Take it when you can get it, man. It's good.
So did you stay there for the full slog? Or
yeah, I actually majored in drugs, a lot of drugs and stuff like that. It was the early 70s to the end of the 70s.
And there were drugs in San Francisco in the early 70s?
Majorly. Yeah. And two things happened for me at the San Francisco Art Institute, because it was like the birthplace of pretty much a lot of the bands for punk rock in San Francisco.
Of course, yeah.
And then there was a huge community of heroin abusers, users, and that was sort of where it went there, you know. Kind of thing. Mm-hmm. So that my career was cinched at that point. You know, musician doing drugs.
So you majored. So you got involved. So how exactly did you get involved in the punk rock scene? Were you just going to shows and you met people, or were people at the college forming bands?
A bunch of bands came out of the San Francisco Art Institute, like the Avengers, the Mutants, the Nuns, people like that were involved, and so it was sort of like just ongoing scene. At 1976, I had hair down to my ass. I was a rock and roll guy going to shows at Winterland and.
Did you go to Dead shows?
No.
Oh, okay.
Wasn't my thing.
Okay.
You know,
hair down but I still didn't make it to Dead shows in San Francisco.
I saw them one New Year's Eve at Winterland, and it was like that, and I think we even took acid and everything.
All right, but, see, I just wanted to drag out that shameful fact from your past.
I just
Patrick O'Neill, secret deadhead.
Yeah.
Yes,
deadhead. He's there. I didn't understand them. There was like 12, two drummers and all this stuff happening, and you know, just what I couldn't figure it out.
As Jerry Garcia said, the Dead are like horseradish. Right.
Like horseradish?
Yes, they're like horseradish. You either like it or don't?
Either
like it or don't, but if you like it, you really, really like it.
Ah, yeah. There you go. Yeah. There you go. Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
And so.
I'm trying to think if I like horseradish. Can't remember.
Well, horseradish is pretty much like, you know, wasabi, right? You know, on sushi.
Right.
Yeah. So
right,
it's pretty good. Horseradish is pretty good. Yeah.
True that. Yeah.
Well, I'm glad we worked that out. I guess we can end the interview now that we know that we both have a fondness for horseradish. So the Avengers and the Mutants. Did I ever tell you that I knew Sally Mutant in New York?
In New York, right? Yeah. She went out there, right? After all of it. Yeah.
It's funny. It was pretty funny. We were like the punk rock kindergarten, you know. It's like
right.
My daughter was in kindergarten and Sally had her kid there, and Richard Kern's was there. Yeah, in the East Village.
That's awesome.
Yeah,
that's awesome. Punks grow old.
Yeah,
punks get old.
Punks
have
in
kids.
Kindergarten. I remember like one time when we went to like some presentation and like the, you know, the 5-year-olds are singing, you know, their little group play, "This Little Light of Mine." I'm standing next to Richard Kern, and we just like kind of like looked at each other like, how did this happen? Yeah, how did
right?
How did we end up here? And so, but enough about me. Let's get back to you. so you knew these guys from college, and you were going to shows, and were you playing as well? Or
I was playing, but not. I didn't have enough. I wasn't good enough, or I didn't have enough faith in myself to play. I was in a really bad 3-piece band that was going nowhere. Wasn't going to get up on stage, you know, that kind of thing like that. Yeah.
Not good enough to play punk rock.
Not even good enough to play punk rock. You know, later on I had a band, but not in the early days. Uh-huh. Early days was a definite no. Uh-huh. You know.
And so how did you get hooked up with the Dead Kennedys? Because I know you were their road manager for a time.
Well, I was down at the clubs, the Mubuhay Garden, for like every night when I sort of graduated art school and then had nothing to do and no income. And so, you know, why not just go to the clubs every night and hang out and do a lot of drugs, get drunk. And so that sort of happened. I made a lot of friends down there, knew a lot of people, and started seeing us at the club every night. I started working a little bit down there, doing stage, doing security, that kind of thing for Dirk Dirksen. And at one point, a friend of mine who's road manager for Dead Kennedys, and then the sound man from the Mubuhay Gardens was the sound man for the Dead Kennedys, both friends. They needed a roadie, and I got hired on as a roadie for pretty much local shows. And then by about, 82, 83, I got hired on as a roadie for on the road with them all the time. And when it went on for like, six years.
Four and a half, five years.
I think to be exact. Was on the road with the Dead Kennedys on tour for the next, that duration, stuff like that. But and then worked myself my way up the food chain from lowly roadie to head of the road crew to road manager finally.
Mm-hmm. So I didn't realize you were with them that long. I didn't, I thought, when did they break up?
87.
Oh, is that okay? And that was, I think we've discussed this before. That was because that had something to do with the obscene album cover?
Well, it didn't have to do with that. That was just sort of the nail on the coffin, the Geiger poster inside of Frankenchrist. They got busted for that. But there was a lot of conflict within the band between members. And there was really what was going on was we were becoming one of the biggest punk bands in America. And we were part of the band was trying to hold on to their punk rock ideals of playing smaller shows and keeping it more intimate and keeping it more less big conglomerate rock, and we're kind of going push towards there. I mean, we'd play halls that could hold 3,000 people, and there'd be another 2,000 people outside of the street, and inevitably was a riot. And so we were going towards larger venues. That's just how it was working, and there was a problem with that in a lot of ways with what was going on.
You mean
so
philosophically or practically?
Yes,
or
yes,
both?
Yes. Yep. Well, and also you take that next jump up, you lose control of everything. You know, you lose control of the venue, you lose control of what bands you play with, and Kennedy's really prided themselves on taking local acts and putting them on the bill everywhere they went, and keeping the ticket prices down and all that kind of stuff. You know, punk rock stuff. You know, like, you know, not quite punk rock of Crass, where you weren't allowed to make any money, you sort of had to be poor and all that. But it was sort of trying to keep with the original ideal of punk, which was a reaction to the bloated fat tours of, you know, the old days in the 80s rock and roll, you know, right. 70s rock and roll, like that, you know.
The yacht rock. So when were you working with Flipper? When was that?
Be 84. Did a tour with Flipper. Probably one of their most extensive tours. We were out for 3 months. We drove out in the bread van, the International Harvester bread van that's on the cover of Gone Fishing, and had a residency in New York City, the Lower East Side, for a month, and played a lot all the East Coast from there, back and forth, and that was quite the tour.
I saw one of those shows too, the matinee at CBGB's.
Yeah, yeah, absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, that was a great show. I was a little disappointed at CBGB's at that point. It had gotten deteriorated down to almost nothing at that point. The sound system was a Sony Walkman glued to the wall.
Yeah,
you know, it's just like, oh my god.
But that was a funny place, right? Because it had its obvious heyday in the, you know, in 76 or whatever around then, and it just kept going for like another 30 years. But there were still, I saw a lot of, I mean, I was seeing really good bands there in the 90s still, you know?
Well, it's kind of rite of passage to go play CBGB. You kind of want to do it. I mean, it's regardless of whatever it was, it's sort of like, that's like a birthplace of East Coast punk rock and stuff like that. So it's kind of, but you know, I was thinking about it. Like I was thinking, oh, CBGB's was a shithole. All the punk clubs were a shithole, you know. It didn't matter which city you're in, the famed punk club of that city was a shithole.
Of course.
You know, just happened to be the MAB was our shithole, so it was a little bit better. It glowed a little better, you know, like that. Like, you go to other cities and go, what a shithole that is. And then you go home and go, oh, yeah.
We played. And, well, yeah, CBGB's, the famous bathroom at CBGB's.
Oh, was, God, disgusting.
Yeah, it's probably, you know, where Ebola started, you know. But
exactly where it did. SARS happened there.
So you're working with both bands at the same time?
Yeah, well, I mean, you know, the nature of touring is you got to keep going. And if you're going to keep, you know, make a living off this deal, you just sort of jump from other bands. So I toured with TSOL during that time too. I toured with the Subhumans from England. Dead Kennedys mainly was my bread and butter, and then a few short things with like Frightwig and a couple other like Samsco bands, just short little pieces there, and then went on to do other work later on with California tours with like Ramones and short little pieces with other people like that, you know, nothing. But that, I worked for the promoter at that point, not with the band, you know.
I see.
Kind of things like that.
You were kind of like the go-to road manager. Patrick will take you out and take care of you.
If the band was full of drug addicts, the go-to guy. I did a tour with the Dickies, a short little tour with the Dickies out of Los Angeles, and my main job was taking them to the methadone clinic every morning, so they were okay. Well, Stan and Phil, the Philip lead singer, so I'd make sure they go to the methadone clinic. You know, it's like those kind of things like that. You know, so that was it. You know, was my expertise.
So while this was going on, were you making visual art at the same time, or were you writing at all back then?
Not doing anything.
Just hanging out, getting fucked up, and
pretty much, you know, like that. I had a band during this period. It was called the Pillage People. And we are a concept band, and we played the all the clubs in San Francisco, and there was like five or six core members, we'd usually borrow instruments because we probably didn't have any, or they'd be in hawk, and we would get up on stage and sort of play this droning, you know, dirgy kind of like Melvin-y Flipper-esque kind of music. And then about halfway, well, not even halfway, a quarter into our hour of performance, we'd invite other musicians who are in the audience up on the stage to start playing our instruments. And then the band would retire to the bar and drink while we watched the band play. And we would get paid for, you know, basically putting together an impromptu jam session. We called it art. You know, this was an art concept. You know,
like that.
That went on for a little while until people got wind of what we were doing and then said, you know, forget it. You guys suck. And we sucked. We were horrible. You know, so that was, and I had a few other things I was trying to do. I played in a couple other bands that never went anywhere, and I was continually telling everybody about the album I was recording, but really I was just sort of in the studio doing a lot of drugs, trying to be Keith Richards, you know, that kind of thing. You know, that was pretty much it.
Yeah. And to I think to really properly be Keith Richards, you need a couple of things, a few things that your average junkie musician does not have.
Like $1 million.
Like $1 million. That would be one. Or many millions of dollars. Two,
right,
you
many
need,
millions.
Two, you need bodyguards, right? To like keep you, you know, to watch out when you get into trouble.
Did you read Life? He like Burroughs as a nurse. You know?
Right. You have to have your own personal nurse with you on tour. And of course, a $500 an hour lawyer on retainer, right? That's really what it takes to live the Keith Richards lifestyle properly.
Exactly. You know, it's amazing. We would like get in a van with, you know, 5-6 obvious drug addicts and drive across America with a, you know, the back of the van filled with instruments and just sort of arrive in somebody's town. We were exactly what the police were worried about.
Right.
We were invading their city. We'd come there. We'd be drugged out. We'd probably have sex with their daughters. You know, every fucking fucked up thing we go and then just keep moving.
You're the barbarians, you know, at the gate. Yeah.
Exactly. You know, it was like, it was pretty, I mean, I was amazed that we never just sort of got, you know, just dragged down and arrested. I mean, a couple of times there was arrests and things like that happening, but I mean, you know, like when I say I did not doing life in prison in like Wyoming or something like that for, you know.
So how did I just have to ask, how did you, you're driving all the way across, like you're driving from San Francisco to New York.
It
takes 3 days, maybe 2 days, probably went nonstop. And
well, if you were lucky with tours, I mean, even though the booker never really cared about logistics, it was like, you know, one night you're in Denver, the next night you're in, you know, Salt Lake City or something like that. It's like, you know, and that's probably a short drive, you know. The East Coast, at least things are closer, but the West Coast are farther away. So hopefully the booker's got you making stops along the way out there on the way back. You know, you're not just getting in the van driving to the East Coast. You know, hopefully there's a Denver show or a Chicago show, or a St. Louis show, things like that, you know, but not always. Sometimes sometimes it was like San Francisco and now New York. You know, it was like, so it was pretty bad, you know, like those kind of things.
I don't know if I ever told you this, but I was actually a road manager once on a short tour, 2 week long.
Yeah.
For my friend's band, the Spitters, who were like a big deal in New York City for about 6 months in the early 90s, you know, and we got a gig opening up for Cop Shoot Cop. Do you remember?
Oh, cool. I love Cop Shoot Cop. Yeah,
they were great. So it was like the first gig. It's like we're in New York and it's like, okay, first gig is in Dallas. Come on down, guys.
3,000 miles away, and it's tomorrow night.
Yeah. So we were all drug-free at this point.
Oh, wow.
Or illegal drug-free, at least.
But yeah,
I remember we drove through Virginia, and we all bought, like, 5 cartons of cigarettes, because we were all
Probably could get arrested for that, for transporting, like, untaxed cigarettes across state line, you know?
Yeah, and drinking lots of gas station coffee, and
Then
we got to Dallas, and it's like, okay, next gig's in Houston, then Austin, and we're like, oh, they're all in Texas, that should be
right,
but they're like right. 6-8 no, hours like, apart, like, yeah, and then it's like, okay, next gig's in St. Louis, we're halfway in the country. It's pretty ridiculous.
No, I used to get itineraries for the tour and look at it and go, oh, I'm not sleeping for the first week, you know, like bouncing all over the place, bing ding 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 ding, it's like, oh my god, you know. So Yeah, bookers don't always think about where you're going or what you're driving. They just want to get the gig in there. It's the weekend. We're going to put you in five places, 500 miles apart. Here you go.
But I'm curious. So, how did you manage the drug intake? Like during all that travel, so did you were traveling with drugs, or did you get hooked up when you arrived in the town? Or
you never, you know, you always think you have enough, but you never do, and so you inevitably you're in some horrid biker bar in Norman, Oklahoma, talking to the only guy with pinned eyes, you know, seeing if he can score you something, or you're buying a couple of Dilaudid pills in Denver for $30 a piece and getting gouged like there's no tomorrow, or you're just, you know, sick for a couple of days till you hit the Lower East Side. I mean, that's just sort of how it went. Initially, I was able to sort of kick before I left, so I would, like, you know, go for a couple of weeks and kick and sort of be okay, but the nature of the beast is I'm a drug addict, so somebody would offer me some heroin in Denver, and I'd be like, oh shit. And then I'd, you know, be strung out again, you know, like that's just how it sort of worked. So it was a lot of scrambling, and, you know, as long as you're in a major metropolis like Chicago or, you know, New York or DC or any of the big towns that have a nice drug population, you're okay. You know, but, you know, still little shitholes. It was not good.
To go back to Keith Richards, I think it was in Life, or maybe I heard it somewhere else, but his strategy was he would clean up before tours, and while he was touring, he would just, like, drink.
Right.
Yeah.
Right, exactly.
Yeah, and then he would, like, you know, they're off tour, you know, they're on tour for 6 months, and then they're off tour for 2 years, and he would just get strung out, you know, and...
Yeah,
stay in bed for 2 years, you know.
Well. Right.
So you did this for a big chunk of the 80s, and when did it all end and fall apart? Or did it fall apart, or did you just gradually end?
Yeah, it totally fell apart. Will from Flipper died in 86, I think that was. 80, no, Will Flipper died in Flipper died 87. And so, I mean, that band had fallen apart anyway. They were a total mess. Subhumans didn't come back to America for a couple of years. So with them, TSOL totally disintegrated. They went metal and sort of fell apart and turned into I don't know what. And then the Kennedys' last show was in Chico State in 87. Or is it Davis? I always get them mixed up. I forget. But anyway, yeah. And so it all came to a screeching halt for me, and by that time I was pretty unemployable anyway, so it didn't really matter. So I became the art department for Alternative Tentacles, Biafra's label, instead. That's how I went in and did that. So I was there for the obscenity bust with the Geiger poster. I was in the office when the feds came in and kicked in the door. And, yeah, it was kind of a little weird. A little scary.
And was that the end of Alternative Tentacles when that happened?
No, they actually survived. They're still around now.
Okay.
It's still there. They're still churning out a lot of albums with bands that are kind of listenable. But still good. Still there.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And how did you, what was your next job after?
after
running the, how did you, you know, guy with a punk rock musician's drug habit, not in the punk rock business. How did you manage to support yourself?
Well, I, to be fair, I did go down to LA for a little while, and I worked for the Golden Voice, the promoter down there, and I did a couple small tours with the Dickies, and I worked stage for a while, and I was pretty horrible. Nobody really wanted to hire me. I worked for Rat Sound, which was a Black Flag's old sound company that got quite big, and they were doing a lot of shows. So I would load in, load out, and get my money and go buy drugs. I got kicked off the first Lollapalooza tour because I was too much of a drug addict. I was there for all the rehearsals, and then they said, you know, we don't need you anymore. Get out of here. And at that point, I just couldn't really do any tours anymore. I just was a mess, and I couldn't do stage anymore. So I returned home to San Francisco to find a glorious career in criminal activities to procure my drug habit, and which eventually led to armed robbery and bank robbery, mm-hmm. basically.
Yeah,
and that's where the career move went.
Yeah, that's one of the things I admire about you is, you know, I know many people who, like, you know, got into crime to, you know, support their drug habits, but they were like kiting checks or mugging, you know, yuppies or whatever. Right. You just like went for it though. I like it. Just, you know,
I was tired of being sick.
Yeah.
I'm tired of being dope sick and thought, you know, where do they keep the money? Where do they got the money around here?
Yeah, it's the old Willie Sutton line, right?
Right, exactly.
Why'd you rob banks? That's where the money is.
The money is. Not that it helped me any, because I, you know, couldn't keep a penny in my pocket no matter how much I had. So, you know, it was a bit of a mess. Yeah.
Right. And then you talk about this, of course, in your first book, Gun, Needle, Spoon.
Yeah. Yes. That whole descent into the old criminal enterprise and then sort of out of it. Kind of like that. But yeah. Yeah.
And you know? And how long were you able to maintain that before that all came crashing down?
A couple years, you know, I probably could have, if I hadn't been such a to the curb drug addict, I probably could have maintained it for longer, but I just started getting sloppier and sloppier. And the people that I was doing crimes with sort of fell by the wayside. One of them died, one of them left town, you know, that I'm sort of with these people that are as screwed up in drugs as I was. And, you know, to tell you the truth, and it's in the book, I was in fear of being arrested. So, you know, when you're in fear of being arrested, you naturally do more drugs, which makes you more insane and, you know, less cautious. And, you know, by the time the police kicked in my front door, I pretty much were begging them to come get me by my actions. Right. You know,
so you weren't like one of those serial killers in the movie. You're begging to get caught. You know,
yeah, right. Writing them taunting notes. I'll rob your banks, you bastards.
writing doggerel to the newspaper.
Classic. This is a classic. We were getting written up in the local newspapers. You know, like armed gang robs bank again, and we, of course, here's the brilliance of it. You know, we're punk rock, so we all wore black. You know, and there was articles in the Chronicle and a few other local newspapers. The men in black were they called us the men in black were robbing, and so, you know, I. Just like anybody that gets good press, I cut them out and taped them to my kitchen wall because, you know, I was like, you know, this is awesome. We're getting written about, and, you know, like a good record review, but it was more like a review of our banks. I get pissed off about a few things. And so when the cops came and kicked in my door, there was a whole wall of articles about, you know, the men in black. It did take like a brilliant guy to put two and two together and figure that was probably us. I wasn't just an aficionado of good bank robberies, you know?
So in other words, if you had like changed your shirt more often, you probably could have kept going for years. If you'd put on a yellow shirt once in a while.
Right. Or, right. Yeah. Like to wear a little, just a nice, some nice colors, you know?
Yeah.
Hawaiian
shirt, candy stripes. Yeah,
exactly. You know, but no.
And, so you ended up then under the beneficent care of the California
state of California
California. Uh-huh.
Yeah, they initially offered me 25 to life as an incorrigible criminal, and I fought the case with a lawyer and ended up taking a 2-strike deal and definitely about a few years in prison, and that was about it. You know, the DA talked to me and said, called me outside of court and said, "We found a cost efficient way to deal with people like you. We're going to 2-strike you, and you're such a bad drug addict. When you get out, we're going to strike you again. We're going to give you 3 strikes." You know, and I was like, "Oh."
Just okay. Like automatically, no matter what they said?
Well, no, when I get out, I was going to do another crime.
Because they knew you were just going to fuck up instantly.
I was such a degenerate loser that was going to happen. And I was like, I don't care, just let me out.
Yeah.
You know, but all I heard was like, you're letting me out? This is awesome. You know, so yeah. But yeah.
You know, the one, I've only been arrested and spent a couple of nights in jail once in my life. Yeah. Which is obviously not the same as going away for a few years to prison, but it gives you a taste. It gives you a
none
taste.
None of it is a good time.
None of it is a good time. It was 48 hours that felt like about 4 months.
Oh, yeah.
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 And but my cellmate, my celly, was this poor bastard who just he's telling me his story. He just like finished like 15 years at Attica.
Nice.
And they dropped him off at Penn Station, you know, with $20.
Gate money.
Said, good luck.
Yeah, exactly.
And he, you know, when he walked like 4 blocks over to Macy's and tried to shoplift a shirt, and he got caught. And he's like, yeah, I'm going back to another 20 years.
Just God. But Attica.
But it seemed like he was ready to go back. You know, he really seemed like that was like, you know, he's like, oh, what the fuck am I doing out here? Send me back to prison where I know where.
I mean, you think about it, 20 years, a shitload happens in that 20 years. Things happen. People have now television sets and cell phones and all this stuff like that. And you're like, what?
Yeah, he was,
you know, it's like crazy.
He was confused. He was actually kind of happy. You could tell that he was like, he was ready to just like, get me back out, back up there. At least I know what's going on up there.
Yeah. Well, there's a certain, you know, that's why the people get institutionalized. There's a certain comfort in the fact that you're going to get fed 3 times a day and you know what to do. Your laundry gets done and things happen and, you know, there's some kind of health care and all these things. It's not like you got to pay rent. You know?
Yeah.
It's like,
I actually knew some people in New York back in the day who that was their MO, is like they would get caught for like a, you know, shoplifting in like November, and they knew they would get they would get 90 days, you know, and they, you know, 3 hots in a cot.
They'd ride out the winter.
Yeah, they'd ride out the winter. Yeah.
Plus, get to celebrate Christmas. That's awesome.
It's nice. You know? You know, it's good. They had a plan. You know, they had a life plan.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
maybe not for everybody, but it worked for them. And so I got this is one of the things, one of these days I want to ask you this stuff more in depth, but you're a smart guy, an intelligent, educated guy. Well, you know, it's all relatively, I imagine, at least the kind of people that, you know, again, the poet John Ferris once told me, and he had he got busted for having like 2 pounds of pot in like 1960 and went to jail for a couple of years. And he said, you know why I went to jail? I was like, why? He's like, because I was stupid. Right. I was like, only stupid people end up in jail. but true. So I mean, how did you survive? Did you just like keep your head down and.
I realized really early on is you're not in the mix. If you're not doing drugs, if you're not involved with sex, you're not involved with gambling, you know, you're not involved with smuggling, you're not involved with contraband. There's no reason for anybody to really care about you. You know, they you're not going to join the gang. You're not going to be part of this thing. You're just like kind of a lame doing his time getting through. And people sort of recognize that. And they're like, okay, that's fine. And then, you know, my cellie was a serial killer, and he poisoned old men. Him and his girlfriend were poisoning old men to get their property. They would get the old men to write them into their will, and they poison them with digitalis and stuff like that. And so we were locked in our cell for 23 hours a day. And I was like, you know, they come around and said, you want to go to adult education classes? I'm like, fuck yeah, let me out of here. I need to get away from this guy. And be, I mean, cells are, you know, literally like, you know, 4x9. They're like tiny little things. And I started going to these creative writing classes. And it was just pretty awesome bunch of guys in there, because you would sort of be with people who were doing life and people who were doing, you know, a minute, and people like me were there for a couple of years and things like that. So there's this whole conglomerate of different ideas and values. And there was a lot of really good writing going on and stuff like that. And I was never really a writer before that. And I just started writing. I started writing stories about my neighborhood, the mission in San Francisco, where I used to do a lot of crimes and drugs, and the people I was with, and write these nonfiction little vignettes and stuff. And I got a lot of good feedback, and I started writing at that point, and really getting into it. I was on the yard one day, and you know, I turned 41 years old, and I was 40 or 41, I forget what it was, and you know, I looked at my surroundings, and it was just barren and horrible. And I was like, you know, how did this happen? Not like, how did it happen? I got arrested. I mean, I know that part, but how did it come to this? You know, I'm a well-educated person. I shouldn't be probably here in prison with the rest of the people. And it was my birthday, and I wasn't like, hey, it's my birthday. Nobody gives a fuck in prison for your birthday. You know, I'm not going to buy you a fucking cake or something like that.
Cake with the file in it.
And this huge guy with swastikas tattooed all over him walked up to me and said, "Hey," and I'm like, "Oh shit, this guy's gonna stab me." And he hands me this book and he says, "You got to read this. It changed my life." And I realized that he was one of the guys in my writing group, because there's a plethora of them with Nazi tattoos all over them. And it was Annie Lamott's Bird by Bird about being a writer and writing. And it changed my life. I read that book and I go, "That's what I want to do. I want to be a writer." And I, you know, like, if you think about it, like, being in prison is the ultimate writer's retreat. There's nothing else to goddamn do, man. You just write, you know. And I just started utilizing my time to write more and more. And you know, at that point, when I'm in my cell writing like all the time, like, nobody cares about you. You know, you're barely making it to the chow hall. You're just in there doing stuff like that. So that's where it all sort of changed for me. It became a it's not sound like a lame, but it started becoming a positive thing. And I started seeing a way to you know, something to do once I got out of there.
Yeah, I mean, it's worked for a number of people over the years, you know, Jean Genet and
Dostoevsky.
What was his name? The British player Joe Orton. I think he got busted for like some bullshit, whatever, and did 6 months in jail. And he wrote, a play, and he came out. I got a play, and you know,
exactly.
Yeah,
you know. I mean, it's you literally have nothing to do, right? You know, I mean, and no one's going to come bother you. It's not gonna, like, on the, you know, someone's going to call you on the phone, or you know, like, you know, like, you know, you got to do those chores. You don't got shit to do. It's like, yeah, right, we're going to write this thing. Uh-huh. You know? But yeah, so yeah, it was interesting. It was really cool, you know. And then I also, there was a computer class that we got, so I just go in there and use a computer to take my stuff over to hand written and print it out and all this like that. It was like kind of cool, man, you know. So yeah, that was the change.
Yeah, so I mean, with your criminal background and learning computers, you could have gone another way and become like a tech CEO. I mean, it's a perfect sort of training, you know.
Yeah. I still want to be the starving artist guy, you know, like the way my crass roots.
So you got out and you were like committed to writing then you. I guess it took a while, as these things do, and you put out Gun Needle Spoon, which is your memoir about those days.
I also went back to grad school, got my MFA in creative writing, and did it sort of to like, sort of, you know, trying to legitimize myself with all these felonies on me. I sort of just wanted something that showed that I was doing something different from who I was before, and went in and did that, and then my grad school thesis. Some of it was the basis for my my first memoir.
So something to show your PO that you were, you know.
Yeah, so my PO was real. I was actually off parole by then, but show the world, goddamn world, I'll show you.
Yeah. You know. So what are you working on these days? The last time I heard you read was a couple of years ago, and it was a memoir of the touring days. I think that was really funny.
Yeah, I just finished that. Finished the memoir of the tour memoir, and now I'm going through the horrible process of finding an agent and or indie press and dealing with people. And you know, it's always a wonderful thing to get into, sending yourself up there for rejection after another and all like that. But yeah, and I also have a crime novel, a noir crime novel done, that I'm out sending out and doing things with, that I wrote in the interim between the memoirs. It's about a junkie bank robber. Okay. Go figure.
Yeah.
You know,
You write what you know.
Write what you know, right? Yeah. You know, like that. This one's fiction, sort of.
Yeah.
You know,
isn't it like a wonderful process? Yeah. I'm like in the, I'm, you know, as you know, I'm like in this, I also have a crime novel out there.
Yeah. And,
man, it's
I read it.
It's that's right, you did. Yes,
yeah,
you did.
Yeah. Yeah,
and it's brutal out there. You know,
it's hard.
I mean, 2/3 of the people, at least, that I sent it to, there's just like nothing. Don't even bother, you know.
Right,
and then other people were saying, "We really like this, but it's not for us."
Yeah, like, exactly. Or I'm not the agent for this, and you really need someone that wants to champion it for you.
It's like, essentially, really? They're saying it's not you, it's me.
Right. No, they're saying, like, saying you suck is what they're saying.
Yeah,
you suck. It's hard to take that shit and not to take that shit personally. I mean, you know,
like, it is,
you know, this is, or the best, the ones that don't even get back to you. You're so low on the radar, they can't even like say no, you know, like, you know, you suck. They can't even say you suck. They just can't say nothing.
Yeah.
Which,
you know, but
you suck too.
I don't know. It's like, you're really a good, you're a really fine writer. I really like your work,
man.
And that's, you know, you do it because you do it because you want to do it because you got to do it, and the approbation, you know, of actually getting like a big publishing deal. You know, it's like anything else. You look out there and go to like fucking Barnes and Noble and look in their new fiction section, and do you want to read like 29 out of 30 of those books? They're, you know, it's garbage, right?
This is,
I remember the my freshman year at college, I met these guys who were very sophisticated cats. They grew up in New York City, and they, you know, had been going to CBGBs when they were teenagers, and they were in a band, and they were trying to, you know, make something themselves. And anyway, they one of these guys was a friend of mine, and he said, "Oh, I met this guy the other day. He's an amazing guitar player." And you know, I'm just some dumb kid. I didn't know. And I was like, "Oh, is he good enough to be on a record?" And he said, "Anybody's good enough to be on a record."
Right.
So it's like anybody's good enough to get published. Look at all the shit that's out there. But
I know, man.
The publishing industry is so fucked these days. But
plus, nobody reads, so that makes a difference.
Nobody reads, but I hear people say, I read all the time. They mean they're like on the internet, you know, reading like comment threads on Reddit or whatever.
I got 12 likes.
Anyway, do you want to read us something?
Yeah, I can read from the the touring memoir.
Great,
read a piece from that. Let me set this up a little bit. This would be my first tour with TSOL. Okay, so I just go in there. I read about a couple pages on this thing, and the chapter's called "Change for Today." And it's 1984 with TSOL. "That'll need stitches." The nurse is staring at the deep cut in my hand as a rivulet of blood runs down my bare arm and drips on the linoleum floor. We're in the emergency room, which looks like every other ER in America, but this is Denver, and some skinhead just sliced me with a razor. After wrapping my hand with a large temporary dressing to stop the blood flow, the nurse reaches over and turns my head with her hand. "Let me see your face." She wants to examine my black eye, only that's not why I'm here. The cut is a lot more urgent, or at least it is to me, because I can't stop the bleeding. "Don't worry about it. That's from last night. Fix this instead." I hold up my bandaged hand to ward her off so she'll stop touching me. I'm embarrassed enough about the shiner. "Last night in Salt Lake City, two jocks jumped me in the back stairwell of the Indian Center. I was trying to stop a fight between a little punk girl and some large dude that must have been her boyfriend or a friend of the jocks. When dude went to hit the girl, I grabbed his arm, and then all I remember is being slammed backwards into the concrete wall and the larger jock repeatedly punching me in the face. I was going down, sliding to the floor, almost unconscious when I kicked his knee with my steel-toed boot and he backed off. Last night, a doctor is standing next to the nurse. They're both looking at me as if I'm some undiscovered species. You getting a lot of fights?" Now, how do I answer that? I'm a roadie. I load gear into the venue, set it up, and work the stage during the show when the band's played. It's punk rock. The audience continually assaults the stage for their few seconds of hang time. Some grab the mic and shout along to the lyrics. Most do a pantomime with a circle jerk, skanking kid, then dive off the stage. When they don't get off or crash into the gear, knocking shit over, I throw them back into the crowd. Some do not go willingly. Punches are thrown. Is that really a fight? I'm on tour. Shit like this happens. I'm out on the road with TSOL and things aren't going well. At least for me, they're not. We played Seattle a few nights ago. My leather jacket was stolen out of the van. It's fall in the Northwest and now I'm freezing. Then we hit Salt Lake and I get the shit kicked out of me. Thankfully, nothing happened in Eugene or Reno, but I'm worried the band is thinking I'm a liability. Their manager, Mike Vraney, is eyeing me like I had the dark cloud of doom hanging over me. He's bad juju, man. Tonight we're playing Denver and there's a ton of skins in the audience. I'm no stranger to dealing with skinheads. I've worked stage and security at the Mabuhay Gardens and on Broadway in San Francisco. I'm constantly getting into fights, especially with skinheads, and every chance for violence and rat pack mentality. There's also a conflict in our political ideologies. I don't fucking like Nazi racist skinheads. A group of skins at the front of the stage keeps fucking with the mic, and every time Ron steps to the stage to sing back up, they shove the stand so the mic smashes into his mouth. They laugh when they do it, and they're pissing me off. I leap into the audience, shove the group of skins back, and then after getting elbowed and kicked, I hit the biggest one in the head. A short, stocky skin lunges at me from the side. I push him away. They all keep their distance, and I jump back up on stage and right the mic stand. but there's blood everywhere. It's spattered on my boots, on the stage, the mic stand, all over the place. I turn my hands palm up. There's a long, thin slice from my thumb to my wrist on my right hand with blood spurting out at a scary rate. The skinheads are laughing. The short, stocky one waves at me. I find the promoter, Tom Headbanger. He grabs one of his guys. "Dude, drive dude to the emergency room," he screams. As I'm pushing through the crowd, I run into Jello Biafra. The expression on his face confirms I look like a fucking mess. "You okay?" he asks, eyeing my bloody hand and black eye. "Want me to take you to the hospital?" "No, I got this." So what's being on tour mean? The doctor has cleaned all the blood off my hand and scrubbed the cut for the possible foreign objects. With a looping movement, he uses a circular needle and begins stitching the wound closed. I'm a roadie. Every night the band plays a different city. I drive, I load gear, I work stage. Sometimes there's a fight. "And you get paid to do that?" "Yeah. Maybe you should find another line of work."
All right, man. Good stuff. All right, well, thanks so much for being our guest this evening.
You got it. Really, I really appreciate it. Yeah, awesome, man.
Yeah, it was fun. So all right, we'll talk to you soon.
Okay. All right. Thanks, man.
Take care.